Well, as you can see, we're going to be in Daniel chapter 2 this morning. Open up in your Bibles there with me. Last week, I wasn't able to be with you. You were very kind to loan me out to be able to minister the word to the saints in Council Bluffs, and so I can bring back greetings from Southview Bible Church and Pastor Dwight Oswald. My family had a great Sunday of fellowship together with the saints there as we looked into God's word. But I'm glad to be back. This is my home, and this is where I love to minister. And as I contemplated what the Lord would have us look into His Word this morning, I took note that some of you might be aware there's an election happening this week. I don't know if word has gotten out on that. And very many people are very concerned about the results of this election, as they'll be putting a new president in office and this is the most powerful country in the world, the most influential country in the world in our day. I thought it might be good to go back a couple of millennia to look at the most powerful man in the world in the days of Daniel and what God revealed to him, not only for his own time, but for all that history has unfolded since the days of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. We look into Daniel chapter 2. We find here a mysterious dream that God gives to Nebuchadnezzar. And I'm going to begin by reading the first four verses. Follow along in your Bible as I read them out loud for us. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king, and the king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream." Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation." So here we find that the most powerful man in the world, King Nebuchadnezzar, whose reign over Babylon had been set up by his father, and whose reign in the city of Babylon and over all of the nations that are surrounding him would last for about 50 years, that at this particular time in his life, he had a dream that was an unusual dream. Not all of our dreams are a revelation from God. In fact, I've never had a dream that was a revelation from God. But throughout the Old Testament, one of the ways in which God spoke to people was through dreams and night visions, as they are also called. Daniel has a night vision later in this chapter in verse 19. King Abimelech, back in Genesis chapter 20, was warned by God in a dream. Jacob received prophecy from God about the future of Israel in Genesis chapter 28 as he dreamt of the stairway, the ladder that was leading from the ground up into heaven with the angels ascending and descending on it. It was Joseph who dreamt about his own future and what that would mean for his people and interpreted the dream of Pharaoh. It was God who would speak to various prophets that he would come to them in the dream of the night. And even King Solomon, several hundred years before Daniel, was visited by God in a dream in which he was asked to make requests for whatever he wanted. And he made that choice of asking for wisdom above all else. Now, none of these visions from God were sought out, except for what Daniel is going to be praying for later in this chapter. All of these were God's action in revealing something in this way as a matter of prophecy. And for whatever reason, we're not told exactly why or how, Nebuchadnezzar recognizes that this dream that he is having is a significant dream. This is not just a normal type of dream that we have, but that this dream really does mean something. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't know the true and living God. He doesn't know about Joseph, and he doesn't know about Solomon. And he's not aware that the God of Israel is the only God at this point. And so, in wanting to understand his dream as a pagan king, he turns to what all kings before him in Babylon had done in trying to interpret dreams. And Nebuchadnezzar knows that this dream, more than any other dream he's had in his life, has significant meaning that he wants to know about. Now, how did he know that? We're not told. Maybe it was a repeated dream that came to him every night, and that's why his spirit was troubled. Maybe it was because of the thoughts that he was having before he went to bed, and he recognized that this dream was connected to those thoughts, and yet he couldn't understand in what way or what the meaning was. Maybe this dream was particularly vivid in some way, and just left this powerful feeling upon his heart and his mind. But somehow God made this dream special, and he knew that it was a revelation that he needed insight into. And so what did he do? Well, you see there in verse 2, the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans would be summoned to tell the king his dreams. These are the wise men in the kingdom of Babylon, and he would be calling those magicians and enchanters and sorcerers and Chaldeans who were his court astrologers. Astrologers of Babylon were famous in the ancient world. We still have a number of their writings and books. They were able to chart the stars. They were supposedly able to read omens. And they were also supposed to be able to interpret dreams. Now, one of their astrologers, Naburimanu, was able to calculate the length of the year. Now, if you were asked to calculate the length of the year, how would you go about it? This is your school assignment for homeschool. And how long is a year? Try to calculate it according to the second. How would you do that? Now, you might get out your watch and start, you know, January 1st when the sun comes up. And then, you know, stop your watch a year later when January 1st and the sun comes up again. But, you know, they didn't have stopwatches back then. So how did they calculate the length of a year? That would be an interesting research project. But what Naburimanu came up with was that the year is 365 days, 6 hours, 15 minutes, and 41 seconds long. And he did this with his knowledge of astronomy. That's only 27 minutes off, which is not bad from what we know today as the length of the year, how long it takes for the Earth to make one revolution around the sun. So these men, they had a tremendous amount of scientific knowledge that they would also use as astrologers. The difference between astronomy and astrology is a religion, whereas astronomy is a science, and they would try to combine these together. And the magicians, just like the court magicians that Pharaoh had, who were able to duplicate Moses' signs, that they had this spiritual worldview. And so these were those who were the most practiced, the most well-known, those who claimed to be able to have their finger on the pulse of the gods, that they could tell you what Marduk was saying. They could tell you the will of Bel that was revealed in the stars and revealed in omens and revealed in dreams. And they had case studies of books upon books of precedents for all of these things. Like attorneys with a shelf full of precedents, they would turn to this shelf full of dream interpretation precedents and would be able to interpret dreams for kings. This was how they established themselves and their importance in the kingdom. However, in God's providence, in His wisdom, God plants a seed of doubt in King Nebuchadnezzar's mind as to whether or not these men really are what they claim to be. Whether these men really do have their finger on the pulse of the gods, and whether they are an authoritative source on dream interpretation. The king is skeptical about these men, and therefore he makes an unusual request for them as he calls them to interpret his dream. Notice that the Chaldeans butter up the king when they come into his courtroom and they say, "O king, live forever," which is a wonderful thing to tell a king. That they love him so much, you wish that he could sit on the throne forever because he's just such a great guy. And they say, "Tell your servants the dream and we will show the interpretation." This is how these things are handled. You come to the dream interpreter, you tell him the dream, he tells you what he thinks, he might have to go check his books and sources and come up with the answer, but this is how it worked. But the king answered and said in verse 5 to the Chaldeans, and the Chaldeans were the native Babylonians, those who were highest in their society, and were the ones who were educated in all of this wisdom of the Babylonians. The king answered and said, "The word from me is firm." What word is that? Well, that is that he told them in verse 3, "I had a dream and my spirit is troubled to know the dream." So he's not just asking for an interpretation, but he's asking them to tell him what the dream is. He says, the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. So Nebuchadnezzar says, I'm the most powerful man in the world, and the most important thing to me right now in the whole world is to understand the meaning of this dream. And it's so important to me that I understand the meaning of this dream that I'm going to reward the person who shows me and convinces me that they actually know. Not that they're guessing, not that they're just throwing out a possible interpretation, but I want to see somebody who can demonstrate authoritatively that they can interpret this dream, and that person I will reward. But all of you wise guys that I have around me, if my suspicion about you is true, and that you actually are not able to have this connection with the gods and the spiritual forces of this world that you claim that you have, well then, I will use everything in my power to make you suffer for it. Now, if you're a Chaldean, or a magician, or an astrologer, in this situation now, your knees are knocking together. And you want to try to reason with the king to save your life. And so they answered a second time, and they remind him that this is not how these things are done. That you have to tell us the dream, and then we show you its interpretation. But then the king answered and said, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. So here, I appreciate Nebuchadnezzar. He's a skeptic. And there is a good kind of skepticism. There's a good kind of skepticism that wants to say, I want to know that what you guys claim to be, you actually are. You claim to have this spiritual insight. You claim to have this spiritual connection. Prove it. I want proof. They don't have it. Like all the false religions, like all the false ways in the world, men make claims, they make boasts that they can't back up. And here, Nebuchadnezzar shows a healthy skepticism and asks for some kind of definitive proof, and that proof that he has determined is, you have to know the dream. Nebuchadnezzar hasn't forgotten the dream, he doesn't need them to remind him, but this is the test that he is setting up of their authenticity. The Chaldeans answered in verse 10 and said, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. This is unprecedented. The thing that the king asks is difficult. And no one can show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Oh, I thought you were supposed to have a connection with the gods. And I'm asking you to prove that connection and show me the message from the gods. We can't. He's shown them to be liars. He's shown them to be false. He who flies not high falls not low. There's an ancient proverb that describes this situation well. If they had not boasted of this ability, then they would not be falling low when they failed to meet the king's demand. Turn back to the book of Isaiah. A couple of books back, Isaiah chapter 47. Last year, or sometime not too long ago, we were looking into Isaiah chapter 47. This is an oracle given by Isaiah ahead of time, foretelling the destruction of Babylon. And Babylon was famous for her magicians and sorcerers and enchanters, and you see God mocking them here in Isaiah chapter 47, beginning in verse 12. He speaks to Babylon and he says, stand fast in your enchantments and your many sorceries from which you have labored from your youth. Speaking of the city, that the city has been the source of all this sorcery from the time it was founded to the time that it's become great. Perhaps you may be able to succeed. Perhaps you may inspire terror. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let them stand forth and save you. Those who divide the heavens, who gaze at the stars, who at the new moons make known what shall come upon you. Behold, they are like stubble. The fire consumes them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. No coal for warming oneself is this. No fire to sit before. Such to you are those with whom you have labored, and whom have done business with you from your youth. They wander about, each in his own direction. There is none to save you. So God delights in showing the falsehood of liars. And that's what we have happening here in Daniel chapter 2. Now, Nebuchadnezzar responds in verse 12. Because of this, the king was very angry and very furious, and he commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. And I wouldn't be surprised if these wise men who were in the court were not destroyed on the spot by the commander of the guard. And so the decree goes out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they also sought out Daniel and his companions to kill them. Now, why are Daniel and his companions being dragged into this situation? Well, it's because they had been carried off into captivity in Babylon. It's described in Daniel chapter 1, verses 4 and 5. And that as captives in Babylon, they had been trained in all of the arts and sciences and religion of the Babylonians. So they were expected also to be wise men. And you see in Daniel chapter 1, verses 19 and 20, that because of their faith in the living God, that they were actually elevated, that there was wisdom and understanding found in them that was 10 times better than the magicians and the enchanters that were throughout the kingdom. And Daniel chapter 2 shows how this prominence of Daniel and his fellows came to be because of the king's dream. But Daniel and his friends are in this group of the wise men because of their training in the sciences of Babylon. And therefore, when the king decrees that all wise men will be destroyed throughout Babylon and throughout the kingdom, well, that includes Daniel and his three friends. So Arioch comes to Daniel, and Daniel replied in verse 14 with prudence and discretion to the captain of the king's guard, Arioch. And he declared to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent? Now, why is it so important that you kill us now?" And so Arioch told him what was going on. And when Daniel heard it, in verse 16, here we're moving into the second part of our outline. In Daniel chapter 2, we're seeing the mystery is going to be revealed in verses 14 through 23. So Daniel learns of the situation, and what does he do? He and his companions seek for time to be able to make the matter known to the king. Daniel went in, requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. And so, having received time, Nebuchadnezzar says, "Okay, you can give it your best shot." The most important thing on Nebuchadnezzar's mind right now is to know the interpretation of this dream. And so, if he thinks there's someone that might be able to do it, even though he's angry and furious at the wise men, well, he's going to give them the chance because his top priority is understanding this dream and any hope he's going to hold on to. So Daniel went to his house in verse 17, and he made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. And he told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven. You see this time and time again in difficult circumstances in the Old Testament that the man of God does not pray alone. The woman of God does not pray alone, but that she seeks out others. And here, Daniel seeks out others to pray together with him for deliverance and mercy in the day of trouble. There's a great verse in the Psalms. I don't have the reference with me, but it's one that I've memorized, where God says, "Call to me in the day of trouble. I will answer, and you will glorify me." And that's exactly what happens here. Daniel and his three friends turn to God in prayer in the day of trouble. Their lives are on the line. They're going on death row today. And they're going to the Lord in the time of trouble. And we're going to see that God answers them. And then they glorify Him. What a wonderful sequence of events. Call to me in the day of trouble, number one. Number two, I will answer. And number three, you will glorify me. This is how God has chosen to work. So, he enlists the prayer support of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Verse 19. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel. Now, you see the word mystery in all parts of our outline this morning. It's going to be in the third part as well. And the biblical definition of a mystery, which is an important word in the Scriptures, it's a word that comes up often. It's important for understanding books like Revelation, where you have these mysteries that are being revealed. A mystery is something that a human being could not know or discover or discern unless God reveals it, unless God shows it. A mystery, like when you're reading a mystery book, it's something that you're not supposed to figure out until the author of the book shows it and reveals it at the end. You're reading the Nancy Drew book, you're seeing all these people introduced and this mystery set up, and then the author is the one who knows the answer and then who gives you the answer at the end. And that's the way it is with the Scriptures, that God is the author of history. And He set up things that human beings would never discern, would never figure out, would never discover, apart from Him revealing it, Him telling us what that mystery is. And so here you have a mystery that is this dream that Nebuchadnezzar doesn't know the meaning of. And God reveals the mystery. He's the only one who can do that. The mystery was revealed, in verse 19, to Daniel in a vision of the night. Very similar to the dream. Perhaps there is something different between a vision of the night and a dream, or maybe they both refer to the same thing. That's a matter that I'm not firm on in my interpretation. I could go either way on. But in either case, God reveals it to Daniel. And Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Now, notice that the knee-jerk response of Daniel when threatened is to go to God. And that God quickly answers Daniel's prayer. And then the knee-jerk response to answered prayer is praise. So Daniel immediately goes to prayer, and as soon as the prayer is answered, he immediately goes to praise. This is a model, a pattern that we're supposed to be following in our lives as well. And so Daniel answered. God revealed, Daniel answered and said. Now, we're not told who he said this to. He says it to God, and he writes it down. This is probably Daniel's own recording of these events in Daniel 1 through 6. We think Daniel is the author of his own book. And that he writes this down, and that this is an important part of the event that he wants us to remember, is his specific praise. You have specific prayer, a specific answer, and specific praise. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things, mysteries. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with Him. To You, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for You have given me the wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of You. For You have made known to us the king's matter. There's the specific praise. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the king's matter. And building up to that specific praise, he praises God for his sovereignty, his power, his wisdom, his knowledge. And that God, the God of his fathers, is the one that he is praising. He's not praising Bel, not praising Marduk, none of the gods of Babylon where he's been hauled off to and where they've tried to indoctrinate him. But living in a lost world, living in a dark place, he has held on to the faith of his fathers that he had when he was a boy in Jerusalem. Wonderful testimony. Wonderful example for how we are supposed to live in a dark world. So, the mystery is revealed to Daniel, and that brings us to the third part of our outline. The mystery explained to the king. There in verse 24. Therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation." Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said thus to him, "I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation." Well, thank you, Arioch. You are amazing. And the king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation?" Daniel answered the king and said, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed are these. To you, O king, as you lay in bed came thoughts of what would be after this. And he who reveals mysteries made known to you what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be made known to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your mind." Daniel, as opposed to Arioch, does not self-promote in this situation. He self-deprecates. And he recognizes that this situation is not so much about Daniel. Now, this is the book of Daniel, and he's the main character, and you might think, well, this is about Daniel. No, it's not about Daniel. That this dream is about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the one who got this dream. Nebuchadnezzar is the one whom God has chosen to reveal what was going to happen in the future. Now, why? Why did God choose Nebuchadnezzar to be the one to receive this dream? Why didn't he give it straight to Daniel? Daniel could have written it down, could have been given to all God's people. Why Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar is the king whom God chose to destroy Jerusalem. What's the connection? Why does that mean that Nebuchadnezzar is the man who receives this dream about the future of mankind? Because God had revealed to Moses his plan for his people Israel. That over the centuries, God was going to bear with the sins of the people. He was going to reprove them for their idolatries, for their turning away from him and the breaking of his law. And that after sending prophet after prophet and being patient generation after generation, that finally the time was going to come when God would judge his people, the nation of Israel, by sending a foreign power who would destroy them utterly, would carry them off into captivity into a foreign land, like Daniel has been carried off to a land where he had to learn a new language, where they had new customs, new religion, and to dwell there. And everything that God said about his plan for his people through Moses had come to pass. Just like we've been studying in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah looks back and says, well, everything God said, it's happening now. And now, a little bit later, after Isaiah's time, it's come to full completion. And Nebuchadnezzar is that man, chosen by God to destroy the temple and to bring the people into captivity. And so all the nations look at Jerusalem and they say, there's no God in Israel, or if there is, he's very weak compared to the gods of Babylon who have conquered and destroyed the gods of Jerusalem. And God is now declaring to this king, the one who had burned his house in Jerusalem, that I am the one who appointed you. I am the one who sets up kings. I am the one who has a plan for the ages, and I'm going to reveal to you, Nebuchadnezzar, what my plan is. And through this man, who was the first to trample upon Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is going to be trampled upon until Jesus Christ sets up his kingdom. But from the very beginning, God revealed to the nations his plan through the king that was at the beginning. God chooses a Gentile king in order to reveal his plan for the times of the Gentiles that we still live in today. Back to Daniel chapter 2. The mystery explained. Daniel says, the whole purpose is this, is that you, O king, need to know and understand the thoughts of your mind that God has revealed to you. So pick it up in verse 31. The mystery explained. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, A stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all. You are the head of gold. Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. And as you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. The vision of the statue is contrasted with chapter 7. Let me come back to this picture in a moment. But first, let's contrast chapter 7 with Daniel chapter 2. They're parallel chapters. They both talk about the coming kingdoms, the future empires that will rule on the earth following the days of Nebuchadnezzar. It starts with Babylon, who is the head of gold in the vision that we just had read for us in Daniel chapter 2. But in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel does have his own dream, his own revelation that is made to him and not to Nebuchadnezzar. However, in Daniel's dream, in Daniel's vision, we don't have a mighty statue of precious metals, but instead we have four dreadful beasts. Because from man's perspective, the empires of this world are like statues that are a testimony to the greatness and the power of their civilizations. There's glory and magnificence in Nebuchadnezzar's view and how God reveals to him the empires of this age. But when Daniel looks at the empires of this age, he doesn't see them as a testimony to the greatness of the empire. Instead, he sees them as devouring beasts who come in and destroy and steal and pillage, like Nebuchadnezzar did in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar was this destroying beast. And instead of the intelligence of man, you see the animal nature of these kingdoms in Daniel chapter 7. But be that as it may, we're focusing on Daniel chapter 2 this morning. I just wanted you to be aware of the parallel in Daniel chapter 7 for your own studies. But in Daniel chapter 2, the head of gold is clearly identified as the kingdom of Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar, he ruled for about 50 years. His kingdom was set up by his father. But then his kingdom fell shortly after he deceased. Things went downhill quickly through a succession of bad kings. Just 23 years after Nebuchadnezzar's death, the Babylonian Empire fell. And it was taken over by the Medes and the Persians and Cyrus the Great, who we've also studied about in the book of Isaiah in prophecy. And then after the Medes and the Persians, which is this inferior kingdom, as it's described in verse 39, you have a third kingdom of bronze, which is described in chapter 7 as a four-headed beast, which corresponds to the Grecian Empire, the swiftness of Alexander's conquest and conquering the world in 10 years of military campaign, but then dying suddenly at a young age and having his kingdom divided among his four generals, so that there's this fourfold kingdom, this four-headed beast of the Greek Empire. But then there's this other kingdom that follows, the fourth one, that is as strong as iron. And as we've gone through the head of gold and the silver and the bronze and the iron, the metals have become less precious, but they have become stronger. And that strength of the iron is highlighted as Daniel explains the meaning of this mystery there in verse 40. Like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all of these. And that fourth kingdom is the kingdom of the Romans. And it gets the most attention here and in Daniel chapter 7 because it is in the days of the Roman Empire and the restored Roman Empire, as dispensationalists understand and interpret this vision and this passage, that it's in those days that this rock, this stone, cut out without hands, comes and smashes the feet of that statue. And when God smashes this restored or revived Roman Empire, then the whole thing comes crashing down. Now, each one of these empires incorporated the ones that came before it. The Medes and the Persians took over the empire from the Babylonians. The Greeks took over the empire from the Persians. The Romans took over the empire from the Greeks. They all incorporated the previous power centers into their own. But when it comes to the kingdom that is to come, when it comes to the kingdom that we are looking to, the kingdom of the Son of Man, it's not like these other kingdoms. It doesn't incorporate them. It doesn't build upon them. That they are completely done away with. And then this stone becomes a great mountain. In the scriptures, that picture of the great mountain there in verse 35 that fills the whole earth. Mountains are pictures of kingdoms. And this is the kingdom of God that is being described. And God has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what shall be after this. He determined it from the beginning. He revealed it in history, in time. Not all of this was made known to Moses, that it was in the time of Daniel, in the time of Isaiah, that the coming centuries were being unfolded. And now we live in these last days. We live in the days of the consummation of all of these things, and we can see that all that God has said has come to pass. That there's over 100 prophecies, specific prophecies in Daniel chapter 11 alone, that were fulfilled dramatically, word for word, in the life of Antiochus Epiphanes, the Old Testament Antichrist. And we look at fulfilled prophecy, and it assures us that what God has said is yet to come. That there has been no historical correspondence yet of these 10 toes, these 10 kings that also described in detail in Daniel chapter 7. There has been no historical fulfillment of this happening, and yet it will happen. That this is God's plan for the times of the Gentiles in order to restore the kingdom to Israel. And so when we look at our nation today, we live in the wake of the ancient Roman Empire, Roman law and Roman languages that have come down to us through our European heritage, that there is a time yet to come, that God has determined a day. He's determined these 10 kings who are yet to arise. He's determined the Antichrist who, in Daniel chapter 7, supplants 3 of these kings and takes his place as the leader among the world at the time of the end. And we look to that. We don't fear the turbulent seas in which we live upon as the winds blow and one nation rises and another nation falls, as one king rises and another king falls, as one president rises and another president exits. It's all part of God's plan. And we know the ending. There is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And He tells us, do not fear. Do not be anxious of heart. Do not look around and wring your hands and say, what is the world coming to? We know what the world is coming to. A kingdom with Jesus Christ as the King. A kingdom where the lion and the lamb lie down together. A kingdom where the sword is beaten into the plowshare. A kingdom of peace that knows no end. We know that those who have taken refuge in Jesus Christ will inherit that kingdom, and that those who refuse, not a trace of them will be found in that kingdom. We need to step back sometimes and see God's perspective on history. Be reminded of the God in heaven who reveals mysteries. Many will pay no attention to what God has revealed and what God has said. But let us not partake of that spirit. Let us be different.